The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
And I'm sure some of you are wondering, why is he playing that music? And some of you may even remember that music. It's from the old Hal Roach studios, all the little short pieces they had for the Laurel and Hardy films, the shorts and the feature-length movies, and the Little Rascals, and all those little short vignettes. And that piece was one of Brad Steiger's favorite pieces. We used to play a lot of things like that. I'll play some more during this hour. Many of you may not know, but we lost Brad a little over a week ago. And it's one of those passings that we know because we know Brad. He's simply gone ahead and is waiting for the rest of us. He is one of the most remarkable men I've ever known, will ever know, in terms of understanding the big picture, the great game. And it is a game we're all in here. It's a temporary thing. Many of you know about my experience, and some of you have had experiences where you've gone into the light, and then you've come back, and you know this is not the end of the line. This is probably some damn detour we're put on for whatever reason. School, some people call it. But Brad first came on this program probably 20 years ago, maybe more, about that long. And he became a monthly regular because there was so much to talk about in the world of the paranormal. And Brad's prolific authorship, no one could touch him. He had knowledge of every aspect of the paranormal and other areas of scholarly endeavor as well. He wrote a book about Valentino, for example. But what we have is a legacy that is staggering. And I wanted to bring on that little piece of music and then bring on our guest tonight. First hour, Frank Joseph, who was a very close friend of Brad's for a long time. And Frank is an extraordinary author in his own right, who has done more research into ancient America, ancient history, in terms of things we're being kept from, than anyone else probably now alive on the planet. Brad was the king, and Frank Joseph is right there doing his work as well. Hello, Frank. Welcome back.
Hello, Jeff. How are you this evening?
Well, you know, a little sad, but I have to keep reminding myself that Brad and I have done so many programs about ghosts and life hereafter that I really can't be too sad. I have to remember that. It's not easy to do, but I have so many programs, and I want to ask all of you to take a look at the homepage. And there's a big piece of art there. It's a haunted house. It was Brad's favorite haunted house. The artist's name is there, Danielle Montella, and she gave me special permission to be able to use that piece. And we put Brad's picture up in the upper right corner. And if you click on that piece, you'll go to Brad's page, which I put together over years. And on the left-hand side of the page is a complete listing of all of our our wonderful Halloween programs, over 10 of them, I think, 10 or 11. And you can look at the art entries. We always had art entries and real ghost story entries. And then you can listen to each program, hour one, hour two, or hour three. And I'm sure, Frank, you heard some or many of those over the years.
Yes, I did. Yeah, I've known Brad since 1995, so what is that, about 22 years, something like that.
Yeah.
And I knew him long before because I read some of his books. I was going to say most, but that's impossible because he wrote 171. He published 171 books. How many he actually wrote? Probably closer to 200.
Yeah, yeah. And we have to look at it in terms of not only books being published, but how many people have read those books. Those books were always passed along. Minimum 50 million, maybe 100 million readers. We don't know, because those books are so unique. And they were the kind of book that you'd say, hey, I just read this. You got to read this stuff. It's amazing.
Yeah, I think Brad's greatest achievement, and he had a lot of great achievements, but was as a man. What I mean by that was he reached a great pinnacle of success that a lot of writers like myself strive for, and it's very few of us that can reach the top. And usually when they get to, when a writer gets to the top, it's typical that they don't want to have anything to do with anybody else. So if you go to somebody like Stephen King and say, hey, I'd like to have an endorsement for my book, you know, you won't get the time of day. You'll get nothing back. But Brad was the exact opposite. There are numerous stories, especially I've heard since he passed away earlier this month, of people who are just starting as writers, don't have any credentials at all.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll go to him, and in virtually every case, he tried to help him out. What amazed me is that, and he certainly helped me out, what amazed me about him was that he didn't just do it because he was a nice guy. He would actually read your book and understand it, and in the space of a short paragraph, he could encapsulate it. And that takes a lot of mental acuity. And he certainly had that.
Well, it also takes a lot of heart, and he certainly had more than his share of caring and kindness. And Lady Sherry is the same. They were a remarkable couple, and I hope Sherry might be listening, but if not, she is certainly in our prayers and thoughts. The thing about helping people, Frank, is so true. There would be people who would call into the program, and they'd ask Brad, can you give me a pointer on how I can maybe get my book published, or what do I do? He was always so kind about it. Always.
Yeah, and that's rare. That's extremely rare in the business. And he had a great generosity of heart. But I think that even stemmed from his real fascination for the paranormal. You can put that in a very broad sense. He was so fascinated with it all his life that anybody that was seriously looking into it, he regarded as a colleague, regardless of whether they had any credentials or any so-called success. He regarded all of us, I think, as fellow researchers.
Colleagues, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. You're totally right about that. He always spoke about other authors with complete support, kindness, encouragement. Yeah. That's exactly right.
The first book of his that I read was called Atlantis Rising, and at that time, this is back, in the early 1980s, and I was just getting into the subject. And although that book came out, 1974, I think it was released, I still refer to it after all this time. He still had things in there, issues that nobody else raised.
Uh-huh.
When I first read the book, I was kind of annoyed with it because it had great material, really great, solid historical and wonderful comparative mythology. And it also had extreme stuff, underground cities, UFOs, and all that. And so I thought, oh, that's kind of a shame, you know, because he sort of wrecked it with that. But actually not. As I understood later on, he was a true scientist. By that I mean he put everything on the table. He never in any of his books insisted that the reader agree with him. All Brad ever did is he researched things better than anybody else, and he put it before the reader and let the reader determine what of this do you find worthwhile, and you make your own determination. Matter of fact, he's even said that numerous times. And that is, I think, really a very generous point of view when you consider that most writers have some kind of an axe to grind or a point of view they're trying to forcefully put across. He never did that.
No.
He put the material out there and let it stand and fall on its own merits. And as a consequence, I have gone back to his books. I find that typical also. If you look at Amazon.com and look at some of the reviews of his books, many of the readers say that they go back to his books continuously, or else they'll read it once and it'll stick in their minds, and then maybe 10 or 12 years later they'll go back and reread it. That's the earmark of a great writer, let me tell you, that you can make that kind of an impression on your readers,
mm-hmm.
that they don't just enjoy what you've written, they defer back to it.
Right. It becomes a benchmark for many people in terms of how they approach the art of writing, and it is an art.
And it all came from his own experience, actually. He wasn't apart from this. He was born in a place called Fort Dodge Lutheran Hospital in the midst of a roaring blizzard that's in Iowa. And he grew up on a farm in Bode, Iowa, and he was a typical normal kid, raised a Presbyterian and so forth, nothing outstanding. But at the age of 11, he had a near-death experience, and that experience utterly changed his life. And his book that he wrote about that, he spoke very little about it in his book. He really mentioned it not that much.
You know, Frank, he only mentioned it, he told that story in somewhat truncated form only once on this program in all the years, and I never pushed him, never asked him. He offered it one time, and please, go ahead, you're 100%
well,
right.
Well, that's great that you told me that, because he was very closed-mouthed on that. He wouldn't even discuss that in private conversations. So for him to discuss it on your show demonstrates a level of trust that was really outstanding for him.
Yeah,
the book that he wrote about that, and he mentions it, but he probably described it in greater detail on your show than he does in this book. It's called Children of the Light, The Startling and Inspiring Truth About Children's Near-Death Experiences. He always wanted to write about that from his own experience, but the book is like 90-plus percent on experiences of other children who have gone through this. And it's a very positive book. I mean, it's
right.
about these kids who don't have any religious preconceptions, or very few of them, and they go through this experience of light and a rebirth, a wonderful place. They don't want to come back, even though they love their parents and so forth. They just love this other side, as it were. That's the general overall theme of these various anecdotes that he reports on. And that's his books. Many of his books are still in print. People still honor them. He was also, and this is what really impressed me, maybe not a lot of people these days, he was a master of the English language. He taught high school English, and then eventually went on to teach literature, American literature, and creative writing at Luther College in Iowa. He taught that from 1963 to 1967, I believe. I think it is that immersion that he had in the English language, how beautiful it is, and its capacity. He writes very clearly. Even his skeptics, and he had a lot of them, he had a lot of severe critics, but none of them could fault his writing. They all, I don't know, I've read a lot of the criticism of him, but I don't recall a single person who would have the courage to say, oh, he doesn't know how to write. because he certainly did.
Even
if you hated his book, you had to admit this is a fine piece of American literature. That's rare these days. Going down the tubes, too, along with everything else.
Exactly. When you hang your shingle out and it says Brad Steiger, king of the paranormal, or paranormal research, whatever, you open the door immediately for slings and arrows from lower life denizens who like to criticize people who are successful. So, of course.
You put your finger on it, exactly. They were angry with him because he had such a huge following, and that was a threat to their narrow-mindedness.
Ego.
Which include ego.
Ego.
He had his near-death experience, I guess is really his only near-death experience, when he was 11, but by that time, he had already been writing for 4 years. He wrote his first full-length book when he was 7 years old. And then it was, matter of fact, his first published book was based on that. Later on, it's called Ghosts, Ghouls, and Other Peculiar People, which is still in print. It came out in 1965.
Yeah.
And 2 years later, he became a full-time writer. And as you mentioned, he wrote a biography of Valentino, which was later turned into a feature film. He wrote biographies of Greta Garbo and Judy Garland. None of these had anything to do with the paranormal at all. They also are still regarded as kind of classics in their own field. I think it's really saying something terrible about the condition of American publishing, that here's this guy, Brad Steiger, publishes 171 books, has a minimum of 17 million readers. He has some of his books turned into films, and you would think this guy is awash in money, right? No, not at all.
No.
Made just a fraction from all that.
Right. That's the writer's great, I don't know what you'd call it, burden. You can be a brilliant writer and make 5 cents a book. It just doesn't happen. So, yeah, I'm well aware of what you're saying, and Brad would always actually allude to that. He would say, don't expect to make money writing books. You better do it for other reasons.
That's right, and he did. He did.
Yeah.
His only love in life outside of his writing and his wife, Sherry, was he had an old mansion that he bought on some land in Iowa that wasn't so bad, and he and his wife worked on that for a long time to get it all fixed up, and that was a sort of a lifelong project. But it was one of these places that are never finished, of course, and the place was not in the best shape. But it really fit him. And
I always call it the cat.
That, he had no real materialist interests. You know?
Right. We always referred to his home as the castle. The castle,
yeah,
Steiger.
The castle.
And we had such a fun thing, and it had a drawbridge, and it had a huge oak door in the front, and every Halloween, yeah, they would put the drawbridge down for the kiddies, and they'd come to the door, and they'd give out treats, and the Halloween programs were so special. He was on all year, every month. We'd have different authors on, guests, but I put all the Halloween programs up on the page with Brad, and if you forget where to look for it, just look at the art on the homepage, or if you forget that, look on the left-hand side and just scroll your eye down, left column, until you see the name Steiger. Click on that, it'll take you right to the page. Lots of things on there to look at, all the Halloween programs. And every year, for those of you who don't know, we would invite scary art entries, and people would... digital art, computers, many times would create the most amazing art, and they'd send it in. We'd have a contest, and they have a little nominal treat for the winner, $50 or something, and a book. Mm-hmm. And then we'd invite people to write in with their own first-person ghost stories, ghostly stories that they had experienced. And I encouraged Brad and Sherry to get all these stories that people would submit and put them in a book. And he wanted to do that. I guess he never had time to do it. But they're up for you all to look at. And we would read the top three winners stories every year on the Halloween program and announce the art winners, and they're all up there. In fact, I think the art entries, all the art entries are up there, sometimes 40 or 50 we get. And these are sometimes extraordinary art, just great stuff. And then all through the programs, the music would always play. I'd always play Halloween music. And I was just looking through those CDs the other day. There must be 15 or 20 of them. And just wonderful stuff. We had such fun.
Yeah, it must have been. It's part of the wonderful legacy, I think, that he's left behind. That he was such a nice guy. And that it just is kind of untypical, really, especially in the publishing field. He was
completely.
Not an egotist. He wasn't an egomaniac.
No, completely. He had a 48 Ford coupe, a two-door coupe. And I found a picture of one and put it up. I don't know where it even is now, but I used to have that up on the page, too. And he was always just loving going back and talking about things and about how it was when they were growing up on the farm. And he said they were very poor. They all had to work. And he would tell the story about how, for some reason, the glass was broken out in their bedroom window and his toes would almost freeze off. He's a little kid, keeping him under the blanket. And it, just great stories, wonderful stories about his youth and childhood. And then stories of later on developments in his life, how he got to where he is and some of the people he knew. He knew so many people in Hollywood. It's all in the archives. If you're a member of the archives, you can go back and listen to any Brad Steiger show that we did. All the programs were exceptional. And many, many connections with Hollywood, ghosts, just so many things I can't remember them all. We had.
He also worked in true crime for a while.
And yeah.
Some of those. Yeah, they were sort of like film noir novels, and although they were based on actual events, he didn't have too much of that compared to the crime that's rampant in America today. They'd be extremely mild. But they were beautifully written, and he was compared with Dashiell Hammett and all these people.
Well, Raymond Chandler, he was kind of a storyteller, a Raymond Chandler.
I think if he had continued on exclusively in the true crime or the crime novels, he would have been right up there with the greats. But he wasn't as interested in that. He was interested in a little bit, and then he went completely for the paranormal and things associated with that. He was far more interested in that.
Because of what happened to him as an 11-year-old, I think.
I think that was a real determining experience in his life, to be sure.
Yeah.
Because he was assured that there is another dimension to our existence.
Yep, he knew. All right, hold on, and Frank and I will be right back in just a couple minutes. Think about what you're hearing and the times in which that music was created, the 20s, the 30s, just a whole different epoch. We love to play this music on the program. We played so much of it. It was always fun. These are most commonly related to Laurel and Hardy and, of course, the Little Rascals. Here's one more little quickie. They were like a minute and a half pieces. They were just little fillers and background for the shorts and the movies that the Hal Roach Studios produced. This is one of Brad's favorites. It's called On With The Show. On With The Show. Frank, in the Italian, it's pretty much referred to as Vesti la Giubba, on with the show. Remember that?
Well, not really.
It's an aria.
La Giubba is from Pagliacci.
That's right. The broken-hearted clown who had just done his wife in, but he had to perform, and he sang Vesti la Giubba, on with the show.
It's based on a true story, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, Pagliacci is based on a true story. So Brad would have appreciated that. I don't know if he knew that or not, but the thing that impressed me about Brad, aside from his kindness and his generosity as a man, he wasn't just a collector of tales, you know. He was a true anthologist, and he came to some really interesting conclusions of his own, although he didn't stress them too much. What I'm referring to is one book he wrote, which was, he didn't like the title, that the publisher insisted on it. It was called Brad Steiger Predicts the Future. It came out in 1984.
Oh, no, that's not Brad. No.
No, he didn't like it. No. But when you sign contract, you know, you don't own your book anymore. Most people don't realize that, and they can do whatever they want. What Brad had done in that book is that he had shown a way in which we can get a handle on what could possibly happen in the future by looking at the cycles of history and of the weather. That's all he did. And so he doesn't, and so a lot of readers were disappointed with Brad Steiger Predicts the Future because he doesn't predict the future in that book. He just shows a way that you can do it. He did, though, venture one prediction for the future. The book came out in 1984, as I say, and that's important to mention because his prediction was that we are not going to enter a global warming, which was just then being talked about. He said, no, he thought that the Northern Hemisphere is going to go into another ice age. Now, that was extremely prescient because that is now has been the gathering consensus amongst geophysicists for about the last 10 years at least. And that was the basis for my book, Atlantis and the Coming Ice Age. And there's more and more evidence in the news about these scientists that are saying the cycle of weather and relationship between the sun is indicating an ice age that will come. Perhaps in our lifetime, perhaps not. We can't predict that.
Very well said and true. Many stories are predicting now, are quoting those who are predicting that we are entering at least a mini ice age. And it'll come down as far as, I can't remember, middle of Washington State, something like that. And then, 50 miles further south, it'll be temperate and fine.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. It may not happen as quickly as some...
Oh, no. It could be, 500, 1,000 years away. We don't know. I don't know.
It could be, or it could be 1,000 years. But in terms of the Earth, of course, that's a very short time.
It's nothing.
Terms, it's nothing. The other thing, I think the single most interesting thing about Brad is in this regard, in his work, is he wrote a book called The Star People. The Star People is mostly about alien abductions and reports of people who have had hybrid situations where they have seen other creatures that were... Mm-hmm. In sort of held in stasis, or people that have, especially women that have reported pregnancy, and then all of a sudden they're not pregnant anymore. And there's at least one really great account of that, although there are others that are similar to it, in which this one woman had been abducted for a large part of her life. And then when she's abducted this one time where she was pregnant, now she's no longer, she was shown a large transparent glass-like vessel, and in it was a fetus, and the alien indicated that that is your fetus, and there are a bunch of others that are here. So when Brad was talking about things like this, he suggested that a number of persons who are on Earth now are in fact hybrids, what he calls star people. He didn't presume to know what the purpose of all this was, but he amassed a lot of really thought-provoking information on the possibility that such a thing is, as far out as that is, nonetheless, is more credible than perhaps we're willing to admit.
Yeah, and you're a really scientifically oriented, sociological, archaeological investigator, and I don't think it's so far out, Frank. Why is it? Why would people, not you, why would people in general be so quick to dismiss something when we've already cracked the human genome? We're playing with the genetics of the unborn. We know damn good and well there are all kinds of things going on behind closed, dark doors that would shock most anyone. Hybrids, they're already mixing humans and pigs, humans that can, they're trying to crossbreed. They've done it, humans and pigs, so they can get the organs for humans from the pig donor. It'll be a perfect match, tissue match that works. So all of this thing about these things about ETs coming here, taking females, males, extracting ova and sperm and mixing and matching with their own, I don't find it the least bit implausible. I would expect it. It's biology for them.
No, I think you're absolutely right. It's kind of hypocritical of human beings to dismiss all this as too far-fetched for belief when, as you said, we're already doing it. How long has it been now? I mean, it's been decades where we can send vehicles to another world. The vehicle will land, and it will take soil samples and submit information back to its home source. But yet, if something like that is suggested for happening on Earth, well, that's supposed to be ridiculous. And yet we ourselves are doing such a thing. The universe is a very big place, certainly a lot of room for this. But it was, I think, rather prescient of Brad to write about this when he did. Again, this is back in the early to mid-1980s, when such things were not considered. And he was kind of farsighted in that. It's overlooked, too, that he wasn't just a collector of the paranormal. The man was a superb researcher. One of my favorite books of his is called The Werewolf Book. That is a terrific... I mean, I cannot imagine that he would be able to write that thing in just the space of a couple of years. It looks like a lifetime.
It's a definitive
work
too, and many of his books were definitive. No one could touch them. They were so complete and so thorough in their overview of whatever the topic, and then the data that would fill between the covers was overwhelming. I don't know how he did it. I really don't.
It was really amazing. I don't know how he did it either, because there have been some real frauds in the so-called paranormal fringe science area. I think like Isaac Asimov, for example. Isaac Asimov published far more many books than Brad Steiger did. Hundreds and hundreds.
Guess how?
Exactly. The guy would go to universities and colleges. This all came out after the man died, shortly after he died. He would go out to the various colleges and universities, and he would round up students, sometimes post-grad students, and he'd tell them, this is what you want to write about, and I want you to write this up, and you sign this paper, you'll be given a certain amount of cash for whatever this is, and the agreement states that you can never take any credit for this at all, that I assume all responsibility and ownership of what you write, but here's some money. And of course, the kids, students, are always hard up for cash. And that's how I could never understand, how is it possible this man could churn out these books? And some of them were kind of interesting. He could churn out like 6 or 7 or 12 books a year. I mean, oh my God, what a genius. And they paraded him as a genius, of course, but he was a fraud. He was a fraud. It was just other people's work that he stamped his name on. See, now Brad didn't do that. He didn't have anybody working for him. He never had enough money to hire anybody to work for him. He had to do all that on his own nickel. And to write something like the Werewolf book, as you said, that is definitive. There has never been a book on that subject that anybody can come even remotely close to. And it is well researched, well documented. It's I learned things in there I had no idea, like early man's early relationship with wolves that went back over 17,000 years ago, and just great stuff. I mean,
we got to remember also, Frank, that he began doing this kind of research before there were computers on the internet. And so when he transitioned, it became easier for him, and it actually increased the amount of remarkable research he was able to access.
That's
correct. Libraries and card catalogs.
This is all, he had to do all this stuff in libraries, and he had to do his own traveling, his own interviewing. There was no internet to get this information. I think the Werewolf book was written just about completely before the internet, or the internet was just getting started,
right.
I think, when he finally got that finished. And even an earlier book, which is my favorite of all the Brad Steiger books, this book I cannot more recommend to anybody that's interested in this. I think it's called Worlds Before Our Own.
That's an absolute bedrock classic.
I tell you, I have underlined so much in there, it's ridiculous, because almost the whole book is underlined, and I have gotten so much valuable material out of there from my work and my understanding of things. I mean, that book is superb, and again, superbly documented. So the skeptics, you know, don't they? What bothers me sometimes about the skeptics, they can have their own opinions, that's fine. You know, and they'll criticize Brad and they say, oh, he just makes this stuff up. Really? Well, look at the bibliography in the back. Look at his sources. What, have you missed that? You can't see that? He footnotes these things. He has endnotes. He has sources. And they say, he just made it up. He made it up? Well, what's all that doing in there? You know, they don't read.
They don't even, and most of them, Frank, never even read the books. They don't read them.
I don't think that they do read them.
No,
I really
they can't.
Don't think they read.
An honest man can't read a book and come away and say anything like that. Can't do it.
No, and Worlds Before Our Own, I mean,
Let me say one thing. As I remember, Brad was fully aware that this was a real special, unique, very powerful book in many ways. He would often refer to it. And I think it was republished with a new cover during one of the years we were on together.
Not too many years ago.
Yeah, it was, I can't remember, maybe let's say 10 years, 12 years ago, something like that. The last program Brad did here was about 4 years ago. And then his health, and he had pretty much said it all and done it all. And I would always tease him when he'd come on, all right, what's the next book? What's the next book?
That was with Anomalous Books.
Yeah.
That was with Anomalous. It came out in 2000, the reprint in 2007. I'm looking at mine right now.
There you go. So it was about 10 years ago.
Yeah, in 2007, Anomalous Books did a great job, a wonderful cover.
Beautiful cover.
They did a great show.
He was very happy about that cover. Thank God they
did a good job. Of course, Anomalous Books is a great publisher, a great little, relatively small publisher, but boy, they do quality stuff. That's all that counts. His book, that first came out in 1978, and that was extremely ahead of its time at that time. It still is, actually. It still is.
Worlds Before Our Own, for you listening.
Worlds Before Our Own. Anybody that has the slightest interest in possibilities of human accomplishment before the beginning of civilization, the Nile Valley or Mesopotamia, has got to read that book. It's clear. There's nothing technologically hard to get through. The man had a genius for distilling things that were really just locked up amongst specialists and making it available to average readers.
We got to hear that every month for so many years here, and it's a gap that just can't be filled.
No. You know, when you consider the broad scope of this man's writing. I mean, I can write on Atlantis and Lemuria and so on. Well, he could do that too, plus all these other things with great authority, and the books that last. And that, I think it's his the scope, the magnitude of this man's ability to write on very important things in a very convincing and easy to read manner. That's the thing. He wrote with clarity. That was the thing that
completely accessible.
I tried to follow I asked myself, am I being clear? Right. Because Brad Steiger could know how to write clearly.
He had we had many authors on, some of whom had written a number of books about life after death. Because there really is no death. We go on. That's been proven empirically, because there's a weight loss at death. It's something like a couple of grams. I don't know what it is, but it's our spirit, our soul, it's what we are. It's what drives our physical body. It's like the driver of a car. That gets out of the vehicle when the vehicle breaks down eventually, and it goes on. And we would talk about that with authors, and he was absolutely, without question, committed to and having experienced it at the age of 11. He already had a peak over there.
That experience, this has got to be back in the 30s, the early 30s, I guess it was.
Yeah.
Nobody talked about near-death experiences then at all. They had no idea. And if anything like that did happen, it was immediately within the context of organized religion. So you had no chance of it being anything that was not covered already supposedly by the church, whatever the church was. One of his really insightful books on that was called You Will Live Again, Dramatic Case Histories of Reincarnation.
Yeah.
That's another book that people go back to time and again. His books are not outdated. Isn't that incredible?
No.
He writes about these things, and the exact opposite. They're not only not dated, they're validated, and they shine new light on new discoveries.
Right.
That's just an amazing thing. I mean, that's the earmark of a truly great author.
Well, yeah, he's gifted, a genius, and a communicator. And as I wrote in my little vignette, the king of the paranormal, author, father, husband, and friend. And he was so kind and so gentle with his words and how he would speak to people, and so brilliant in a very calm and unegomaniacal fashion. I've never heard anything like it. Most people can't keep the ego out of it. He did. It wasn't there. Let me play a couple of... We only have a few minutes left. One of the things that he really liked... And I played it often. I'm going to play it. It was the opening to a syndicated series, and then there was the closing for it. And I'll play the. Here's the opening. You have to listen carefully. Footsteps.
It's so easy to dismiss as ridiculous nonsense the idea of a haunted house. After all, who in their right mind believes in ghosts? The thing is, what has happened when several people in the same place and at the same time claim to have had the same strange experience? Is it all a big hoax? Are they barking mad? I don't think so.
No, we didn't think so. Not at all.
Sounds like he had a lot of fun with that.
Oh, we did. Oh,
yeah. You know, there was a thing about Brad, too, where you felt that there was something calm about him always. You could always be relaxed in his presence.
Well,
I met him for the first time in 95, and that was my first impression of him. He was a big man, and there was something kind of soft or nurturing about him.
And kind, kind.
Yeah, it, kind. Like, and it was, you always felt very relaxed and your guard was down. You could let your guard down in his presence. I always felt that way with him. Some people are very hyper, but he was the exact opposite of that. He was always very cool. And an underlying sense of humor that was always active. We had a lot of laughs together. Yeah, he was a great guy. It's terrible. That's the bad thing about getting older. Your friends around you are passing away. And eventually your world gets to be less and less populated by interesting people.
I've been through that in the last year. Jim Mars, dear friend, another one. We miss them. But we'll see them again. No question. Here is another little note. When you look on the homepage or on Brad's page, I should say Brad and Lady Sherry's page. It's their page. You'll see underneath Halloween 2010 with Jeff and Brad Steiger, Timeless Fun. I put it up on as a YouTube, and all the programs are there on the left-hand side of Brad and Sherry's page, and you're all invited to go listen anytime you'd like. Let me play the little closing we would do, Frank, and then we'll say goodnight here. This is our the closing for that syndicated program. It's very cute.
That's it for now. Until next time, sleep well. If you can.
Oh, he'd like that. Well, Frank, thank you very much for being here and sharing all of that. And it's just scratching the surface. The page is there for all of you. Please go and enjoy it. That's what it's there for. And 171 books. Worlds Before Our Own, so many books, and one of my favorites, Christmas Miracles. I love the cover of that book. Just think it's fabulous. So thank you, my friend, and it's been great.
Well, thank you. It was quite an honor to have a tribute to that great man, and an even greater honor to have somebody like that as a friend.
Indeed, indeed. Thank you, Frank.
Okay, thank you, Jeff.
Good night.
Good night.
Okay, and I don't know what else I can say except we miss you, Brad.